Blog Talk Radio.
Enjoying the greatest gift of all, this continues to keep giving and giving and giving, and it gets sweeter and sweeter. Speaking of the gift of life, 59 years and going strong. Thank you, Lord. I'm Mark Elliott, the host of what we put together and call When Black Men Talk, and we've been doing a lot of talk, and I think I said in the last show that we've been on some platforms, Spotify, iHeart, Google Podcasts, Amazon, Stitcher, TuneIn, and we've done 40 episodes on those particular, maybe 41, 42 on those particular platforms, but in reality, we have been talking for 4 or 5 years. I think we put it all together and go 4.5. When you think about that, that's a lot of talking, a lot of yapping, talking, whatever you want to call it. I go back to a time when it was said by a certain someone, whom I may not name right now, but I may name later, they said to, you know, what are we going to talk about? And even when that was kind of spoken, I couldn't say I had an answer. I knew how, ideally we just mainly wanted to talk. And at that point, I want to have us be a place, a situation where men can basically come and talk and get naked for the most part. When I say get naked, not necessarily take your clothes off, but naked in the sense where you feel comfortable, open to speak and not be concerned about someone's looking, judging, or thinking something about you. And I stand back and I look and I go, wow, now we have gotten naked. We have other people who have come on this show and have gotten extremely naked. And to me, that says something. And if you think over the years, if I had to go back and answer that question now, ironically, I think I would say, what are we not going to talk about? Because there's not much we haven't covered in 4 years, and covered openly, honestly, and really kind of dug in. And for me, that says a lot. And basically, at this point now, it still is what it was years ago. It's a conversation, a male's perspective on love, life, and relationships, but that has gone off in so many different areas. But we always stay true to these common things right here. We look for an honest self-evaluation, and we boldly say things that need to be said. We don't shy away. It's not like we speak and we're looking over our shoulders and wondering who's thinking this or who's whatever. Mm-mm. We open up and we speak, and to me, it just doesn't get much better than that. And I'm thankful that we've had the opportunity to do such over the years and continue to do on. I'm looking forward to what can basically, this can basically do in the future, how it may move into the future. And of course, you know, I might have my ideas and things I want to tinker, but at the end of the day, Mr. DeMaurice, it's not left up to me. It's left up to our Heavenly Father, how he chooses to move this and how he has moved this. But I'm going to bring you in, man, and kind of, you know, again, I feel sometimes on Sunday mornings, we get up this early, I feel a little sense of sorry because, you know, I know you like to sleep a little later. You could be doing something else. So I want to thank you for coming up early in the Sunday morning and being part of this, man. How you feeling?
I'm feeling great, man. I don't know how I feel about – I didn't read that in the contract about being naked. And I didn't agree to that.
It was section 45-42.
Yeah, I didn't see that in the contract, but yeah, I tend to sign things without reading everything in the fine print. But yeah, man, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been getting to the nitty gritty about a lot of topics, and yeah, man, I am the culprit who. When I came to you and said, hey, I got this platform, I want you to think about a show. I really thought you were going to do a music blues show, a gospel show, like you've done in the past. And when you came back and said, I want to do a talk show, I'm like, we're going to talk about for 2 hours. We're already talking about sports. What are we going to talk about for 2 hours? And so each and every week you came up with the topic, and we just rolled with it, man. It just I was talking to somebody about the show because they were listening to it. And they were asking if we rehearsed, and I said, no, it's just conversation between brothers, and we just get real with it. And so a lot of people think that it's rehearsed, our answers, things of that sort, but no, we just get the questions and we answer them as best to our abilities.
I love that, man, because I remember, you know, we've done shows where we've had dogs barking in the background, motorcycles going by, and a lot of different things, and it never bothered me because to me, I don't care about that. I'm more concerned about what we're talking about in the content, that background. That's life, bro. It's almost like we can be having this conversation, or our conversation could have had on a street corner, and stuff could have been going on, but the mere fact that we're having it, to me, what was important. So I never tripped out over that, and I love the fact that that person said to you, or we said, no, man, this is spontaneous and impulsive, what we're feeling and what we're bringing to the table, and that's great to even hear that, man. I love hearing it because that says, you know, what we're doing and what they're hearing is real, and that's what it is, this real conversation. And when you think about it, how often does that happen with people? Because a lot of times we have a conversation with folk, they're kind of saying things they think you may want to hear. They're saying some things they're kind of basically trying to put them in a certain light. But are they really speaking real? Are they really opening up and giving you a real conversation? I'm going to say the majority of times not, because we don't really think to do so. So we kind of frame our conversations a lot of times to what we think that should be put out there, but we don't do that here. There's no framing here. What you hear is what you hear, and what you hear, we're not afraid to speak and say. Thanks again, man, for getting up and being part of this. Good morning to you. We're going to do pivot a little bit different this particular show, and maybe not. You know, we're going to talk about holy matrimony in a sense. Now, we've talked about marriage before in different terms, and it's a big scope, so we always find something to go back and kind of look at it a little differently. But I came across this young lady, and I wanted to salute her because, to me, she did something that I'm not going to say it's unheard of, but when you look at the current day times, ooh, it might just be. I want to salute Kara Brokenbrough. This young sister took her wedding vows recently in L.A. wearing a wedding dress that cost $47. I'm going to repeat that because I think some of you may have thought the number might have been bigger, and I want to make sure you honestly understand how much she spent for a wedding dress. $47. You can't even buy a pair of sneakers, a good pair of sneakers, or a fashionable pair of sneakers for $47. And she stood there and took her vows in a dress that cost $47. It's a Shen Blackless gown with a mermaid train. Ironically, after this story kind of came out, this dress has been selling out at the fashion retailers. Now, if the wedding dress itself wasn't kind of at a price that kind of surprised you, the whole wedding of her bride and groom took place and cost $500. And out of the $500, this is what folks did. Someone maybe took out of the $500, all spent totality. Some folks went out, let's say someone went out and bought the wedding cake. Others brought this. Someone might have brought that. But all together, it totaled $500. And to me, they took the focus off the show of the wedding. The big glamour, you know, get together and the bride and the groom. And I was thinking this too one time. I always wonder why we pay so much attention to Prince Diane and Prince Charles and all this stuff. Because we glamorize the fact that them being a prince and she's being whatever. Because I never understood why in this country we pay attention to what they do so much. They get married, whatever. I remember when they did get married years ago. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. DeMaurice. Remember when they got married, they carried it live around the world? Am I correct about that?
Oh, yeah. Television. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. It was disgraceful. I don't understand that either, bro. I really don't. Maybe because, you know, this country, you know, folks who came and, you know, the pilgrims came in, they're a part of that, so they feel like they're still related to it. But all that pomp and circumstance for all of that and knocking off TV shows just so we can see that and witness that. And it's kind of crazy, man, I think it's this fantasy of this fairy tale wedding kind of thing that people still get caught up in, and they're willing to spend so much money trying to have their own version of this, you know, this kind of fantasy we see as the wedding ceremony.
Ironically, you know, a lot of young women or young girls at the time grow up from a young age looking forward to their wedding day, caring, getting it straight, and their parents buy into it. And you always hear, I want that day to be perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect day. We never live in a perfect day. We don't live in a perfect world. We live in a perfect nothing. So it's a falsehood to think that you're going to put together a day. You're going to plan it all by yourself, for the most part, and nothing about it is going to be less than 100. You're setting yourself up for a failure mentally right there. But it starts still in a sense where, from a young child, a lot of us have been programmed to believe you find your Prince Charles, your prince, whatever, you find your mate, and you two go off and live in bliss. It just don't tend to work out that way. But going back to Kara, her words, you know, you have a wedding with witness there to witness you vowing to your spouse, vowing to God that you guys are going to stay together for life. Think about that for a second. You have a wedding for those reasons. The witnesses, to witness the fact that you and this one that you chose to be with, to become one, take vows to each other, and you vow to God that you're going to stay together for life. You're going to be there through the rough times, through the bad times, through the good times. You're going to be there through prosperity. You're going to hang together. You're going to be there. And for me, that has gotten lost, or it's been lost, because we have turned, to me, weddings into a show, damn near a carnival. They just don't sell snow cones. We turn it into, we got to dress this, we got to have this on, what a car must take us from here to there, all of that. And everybody has gotten to the point where they're making money off something that is basically God's put together for a man and woman to become together as a union and to come strong underneath him and be together and grow with his love for life. How did it happen? I mean, we can research and find out, but this is where I see it. And I'm amazed in a sense, and I love the fact of saluting this young lady because she didn't buy into the Brazilla, all that nonsense that's on television, and basically getting crazy to take a dress and make a dress of a symbol that has nothing on it other than covering your body so somebody doesn't see you naked. I remember years ago, I'm in photography, so I had an opportunity to go to this bridesmaid store. The owner and I developed a relationship, which allowed me to come in and take pictures of bridesmaids coming in, trying on their dresses. And I remember the second time I went, the first time I'm there and I'm snapping and I'm looking at the workers, I'm looking at the interaction with the workers and the women that are coming in, the mothers come in, and they, you know, of course they feel surprised, some come in like they've been dragged in. And I noticed that they could never agree upon nothing. There was never, you know, they might try on 10 dresses. This one hangs off there. They can never agree. So the second time I was there, was one lady there she had great patience with the women that came in. She would speak and she would talk to them. And I remember the second time I came to her, I said, you know, you're very good at what you do. I said, you have a lot of patience. She said, trust me, I'm not patient. And I'm going to try to remember exactly, and I want to say what she said to me. She said, I want to say to them so many times, pick a fucking dress. You're only going to be in for 4 or 3 hours anyway. And, man, right. I fell out. And she said, but I can't. But that's why I want to say to them. She said, they bring their parents. They bring their friends in. She said, there's no way you can make a decision with everybody giving you their opinion. And I'm like, whoa. But with that being said, man, I want to get your opinion on how refreshing it is to see a young bride that understands the wedding doesn't make a marriage.
Yeah, I commend her because I have a daughter who's getting married now, and it seems like there's so much wasted energy going in what's happening before the wedding that I just kind of just dip out of all of that stuff because I don't want to be part of the planning and all that other stuff because there's so much emphasis on what happens before the wedding, but it doesn't seem to be a lot of emphasis on what happens after the wedding, what the couple needs after the wedding. Marriage counseling, things of that sort. And I'm not saying that that's where my daughter is because I'm having talks with her and we're going back and forth and she's asking questions. But when you look at society, it's like, okay, once everything is done on that day, understand how do you live from that day on, and there's not enough emphasis on that. And so me being me, I'm kind of sitting back in the cut saying, okay, this couple is going to need some things going forward. So I'm thinking more long range. The weddings are more short range. The other thing is men have nothing to do with weddings other than being in the wedding with the monkey suit, standing in front of the church waiting for the bride. As far as the planning, all that stuff, that's with the bride and her girlfriends and the mamas and all that other stuff. And again, we said it earlier, they get caught up with the pomp and circumstance of trying to recreate this scenario that they've been fed all their lives about being princesses and being married and kind of having the showcase where you're just supposed to have just a certain amount of witnesses or certain witnesses to witness the event. And society has turned this into a money-making machine that you got the bridal magazines, you got the registry, you got all this vacation spots, all this stuff that has nothing to do with how this couple is going to live their lives forever after they take those vows.
Vows. Interesting. Because we don't even just look at weddings anymore that they even contain vows. We don't. We don't look at it no more, bro. Realistically, we don't even speak of them. And what I find interesting is, you know, when we tend to get married, one, you got to go get a license. And I don't even think we realize we have to. You got to go. And that, to me, should kind of alert you to something right there, that you have to go basically sign off. But there's no – you have to basically pass a test to get a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
But to get a marriage license, you just, you know, just sign up and just basically sign.
Sign up.
But here it is. But what happens to the vows? And what I find interesting is a lot of times, not a lot of times, the majority of times when, you know, a couple decides to get married, they got to meet with a minister. And he goes X, Y, Z. Are you really paying attention? What he's saying to you? Because to me, if you decide to take this step, and I'm not knocking that happening, but to me, if you and this person that you care about decide to take the step long before you get to the minister, those things he's going to talk to you about, you should have been talking about among yourself anyway. And I honestly believe I don't think that happens. And what I'm talking about is a promise or an oath. A wedding vow is a sacred promise, a covenant. And I wonder how many couples really have that conversation long before they get to that point with each other. I doubt it. Because you're so enamored that he decided to put a ring on your finger, put a ring on it. You show it to, she goes off and she show it. He goes to his boys. He act like, and he stepped up. And for a man, let's be honest, when a man decides, especially at a younger age, he's going to take this step to be a husband, he almost feels, or he does feel, he's elevated himself some up more in manhood. And he assumes the responsibilities, I'm going to do X, Y, Z. And it's like he starts to believe that he's kind of taking a step up in manhood. It's an agreement. An agreement. There we go. An agreement. So, excuse me, you come from a sacred promise to an agreement. I'm going to come to you with this, Mr. Demarese, because this is where, to me, things kind of get murky. Have we fully understood the magnitude of the oath and the covenant that marriage brings forth, my sir?
No, I don't think so. I think some people may go into it that way, and then circumstances change. And while you were talking, I was thinking about my own situation. I didn't have a wedding. It was I agreed to get married to my ex-wife, and it was in front of a justice of the peace. So it wasn't, for me, it wasn't any vows, anything. I kind of knew stepping up in that situation that this is not going to really last long. I wasn't really thinking about it. The day is a blur to me because I wasn't really thinking about, I'm going to be stepping up doing this, that, the other. It was almost like I was obligated to do it because of the situation I was in. And this was what I was supposed to do. It had nothing to do with being before God, making vows, all that other stuff. I can hear him in the background kind of saying all this stuff. All I was thinking in my mind, like, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to do this. And this is just a formality to a legal business contract. That's how I felt. That's how I felt. And that's the way I went into it. So as far as listening to Vols or listening to what the Justice of the Peace was saying about, you know, this ring means such and such and such, my thing was, let's get this over with. So I don't have to hear her talking about how, you know, she wants to do this and this should be the right thing to do. And I can imagine if I'm from an older generation, I can imagine the newer generation is feeling even less than that. It's basically, so as far as a male, you feel like this is maybe what you have to do because you're tired of running. You're kind of getting pressured to do it. Some guys, you know, they may go into it with, you know, all good intentions, but realize that they haven't thought about what happens after that ceremony happens and setting yourself up so when problems do arise, do you have the conflict resolution skills to get past those issues? Because you're right, you said at the beginning of the show, nothing's perfect. Think problems are going to arise. So how do you deal with that as opposed to all the things that come before that? Which can be stressful, but not as stressful as being in a relationship with a person forever or saying that you will be with that person forever. And if you look at society, I look at society as a whole, it doesn't really nurture for folks being together exclusively. There's so many distractions, so many other things that are happening around the couple, so many vices that they can get into to really kind of destroy a couple and them trying to be faithful and trying to be or honor those vows. So I don't think it's taken seriously. You can see the divorce rate is very high, probably the highest it's ever been in our society, probably 50% and over. And a lot of people I know, me opting out of not getting married. And I was talking to a buddy last night who's married. And he was like, man, if I ever do this again, you come and shoot me. And the only way I'll do it is I'm benefiting and I'm taking care of everybody. Yeah, we all going to be eating if I ever do it again. So so it's like the folks that are in it, they don't want to be in it. And the folks that you're trying to push into it, like, I see the stuff that, you know, you have to go through and endure. And I'm not willing to do that. I'm not willing to give up my, you know, autonomy. I'm not willing to, you know, share with a lot of stuff. I'm not willing to give up my lifestyle to be in a situation where, you know, it's just not for me. So, yeah, I've talked to so many married guys who are like, man, I'll never do this again. I don't know why I'm hanging in there, blah, blah, blah. You know, the kids and the kids are gone. What am I going to do now? They're probably used to the person they're with now, so they're ruined for anybody else. So, you know, they just stuck. And I feel for them, but I sit back and laugh, too, because I remember kind of looking long-term when I was sitting there being married and going, I'm not going to make it through this. I got to get out of here because, you know, and I got to pull the cord now, you know, because I don't want to be there 20 years later, bitter and mean and nobody want to be around me. You remember the uncles that were married, didn't want to be married to, you know, some of the relatives we had, and they just stay in a room mm-hmm. all the time and you rarely see them. When you did see them, they growl at you. I never wanted to be mm-hmm. like that. And so I saw that as the future, and I'm like, I can't. You know what? I'm a fun-loving guy. I like to have fun. I like to bring out the best in people. And if I don't get out of this now, I'm never going to be the person that I think I am. And so, yeah, and I chose to pull the trigger. Others didn't, and you can see the results of it now.
It's interesting because I don't think that we understand the magnitude of the oath and the covenant, even when standing there. I know when I... You know, God, I mean, I know I probably didn't. Looking back all those years, I didn't understand all that. Had a general idea, but to really understand moving it into that area of this sacred promise and the covenant, no. It's taken so lightly, and it's taken understood, taken to where you don't even understand it, in a sense, because you're focusing more on, you know, you two becoming one, not understanding what you two must represent to each other at this point. You make that promise and that vow to each other, and not only to each other, And to me, this gets lost, that you make it to God. It really gets lost because, to me, if we totally understand the vow we make to God, we fight harder to do better, to make it work, to have it, to make it sustainable. And when we choose not to, we can act like we did going in, whatever, but I think if we're honest with ourselves, we have no clue. Because if we choose, if we totally understood and you took the agreement and you took the covenant, then you do better than what you did. At least you should have. Because you knew at that point, you're not only was breaking a promise with her or with him, you was breaking a sacred promise with God. And I assume, my assumption is that you care about a promise you make to him. And I don't think we understand when we stand there and we got our best on and, you know, everybody's dressed up, the little ring girls and brought it down, the guy, they, oh, that's so cute, all that. But mm-hmm. I'm paying attention to what's being said. When he's there and she's there, you're really understanding. You're crying over what? And it's like, what? Are we really focused? No, we haven't been. And that's a good part of the reason why marriages end up in divorce. They really do. Because I think a lot of times we feel a certain way about somebody. I love, you know, even now, you know, you date or whatever. People talk about marriage on the first freaking date. How? You know, I'm looking to be married, and they want marriage for all the world, but what about the vows? Because no one talks about the vows on the first date, or no one talks about them getting married. They don't talk about that. But they talk about the benefits that they perceive they're going to receive from marriage, not even understanding the depths of marriage. And which is really interesting because we view marriage as a product of love. And I want you in my life forever. I feel good about you. I believe you can bring this to me. We want that forever. But if you really look at marriage, this is what they say about marriage. And this is the way the world looks at marriage. When you decide you want to stand there and do this, the legally or formally recognized union of two people as partners in a personal relationship, legally, what legally got to do with love?
Mm-hmm.
What legally has to do with an oath or a promise? What I'm saying here is that they don't care that you love her. They don't care that you love him. They don't care. They're telling you, if you take this step and you come down here and fill this paperwork out legally. And this is why divorce smack a lot of people upside their head. They don't get it. And, you know, a lot of men, you know, we ain't thinking about this. You know, she got the will, and we want that for our win. We're not keeping this in the back of our mind or in the front of our mind. Well, you
she's
go down there and sign that paper. I'm sorry, say it again.
I said she's thinking about it.
Yes. So legally,
well,
it's saying,
yeah.
Yes, you're forming this union of two of your partnership. I don't see the word love here anywhere. I don't see the word here of oath. I don't see the word of comment, promise. Where is it? Legally. it's amazing. You know, what I find to be so interesting, I think a lot of us step to this unknowing. We just have no clue because we come to it for the wrong reasons. We come to it thinking that marriage is going to make us whole. If I can find someone, I'm going to be happy. If I can just enter this, I'll have someone that, you know, to go with, to go hang out with. We can travel. That's not a marriage. Those are parts of marriages. That's not. And again, maybe we spent time going over what the oath and the promise meant to or should mean to us if we decide to get married. It's a good possibility our marriage is going to be stronger. Because I'm sorry, you can't sit down, in my opinion. It's nice. But you can't sit down with a minister 30 minutes before you get married. You think you're ready? What does that mean? What realistically, what does that mean? But see, we're dating in a world to where we're focusing on, let's date to see if I know you, I get to know you, and that should make us a better world. We could look, I ain't got nothing to do with it, bro. At the end of the day, I get to know you, and it's amazing. I've been out, and I've met people, and I've said to them, you know, don't evaluate. I'm just here at the moment. Don't be trying to evaluate me to see where I can fit in your life with a husband, because that's not who I want to be to you. That's not. We spent a lot of time is given to basically that right there. How about we give some time to the oath? How about we give some time to the agreement? What are we stepping into? Understanding. Educate ourselves on that. And when that happens, maybe you will spend $47 on a wedding dress. At that point, maybe your wedding will not cost more than $500. And maybe you will be saying you brought together people to witness the vows to your spouse and the vows to God. And then when those times get hard when you're married, you realize this is what you have to owe up to. This is what you're basically stepped into agreement of. You know, not that, he or she is my soul partner. What the hell is a soul partner? Well, what is that? I always try to figure out.
You know how you might be opening up a new application on your computer or on your phone, and they give you all this stuff to read, and you just go down to the bottom and just press accept because you just want you just want that thing on your phone.
Get past it, yes, sir.
That's how marriage is right now. It's a business contract. The app is a business kind of a deal that you're agreeing to. You ain't reading none of that stuff. You go blah, 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 first three lines. Let me get down to the accept button. Hit the accept button. Now, when the problems come up where they say, hey, you know, you gave us permission to look through your phone and do all this stuff. I never agreed to that. Yeah, you did. You did agree to it because you hit this accept button. So to me, marriages are legal contracts. They're business transactions. And people look at it that way now. They do. It's a business transaction. When you put the legal in, it's a business transaction now. It got nothing to do about love and vows and all that stuff. It's that little button you accepted. Yeah, I'll do it because I want this. I see this as a benefit to me. Them not realizing all the stuff you agreed to, all the stuff that you're tied to legally now.
No, I agree with you. And that's here again, I bring it back to not understand the vows, because you're looking to hit that click button just to kind of get there. You know, from a male's perspective, I agree with some things you said earlier. You know, we stand there, and weddings aren't basically for us, but we realize if we're to have her, and this is what she wants to do, I will come along to make her happy because I want her happy. You know, I want to see her happy. This is something she's been thinking about. But they're not made. They're not primed for us. They're not. And here again, we're looking to get to the point, okay, what are my expectations, what I need to do, the role I need to fulfill as a man. And I said it earlier, some men look at it to step up into manhood. Even that, we're not even looking at it, understanding the role we must play under the oath with the promise. We don't look at it. I want to go through something that is really interesting to me, because when I say the vows, you know, I can't even, the most things that we kind of remember about our weddings and the vows is, you know, the honor. You hear all that stuff, the honor and obey, whatever. You heard that before you got married. You heard that on television. So that doesn't really say much. So realistically, the vows of understanding the vows. And there's seven vows that take forth when a man takes on a woman to be his wife. I know that sounds romantic. When a man takes a woman and finds a woman, yeah, that sounds great. But there's seven vows. And one of them is prayer for food and nourishment. Think about that. Prayer for food and nourishment. Now, the food is not only the food that you're basically preparing to eat, and the nourishment that will bless your body is the food that you two give each other to strengthen you two, to grow strong as one. The word strength is a vow, part of your vow. The strength of you two here again, working, as you said earlier, not always seeing eye to eye, learning how to basically work through stuff. And when you do, it strengthen you two as a union, as a partnership, your relationship, prosperity. Doing things to elevate you two as a couple, to grow together, grow closer. It's part of your vow. Family, and the family that you can develop and grow forth with. Progeny, children that you're going to bring into this earth, because that's what we're here for. That's what we're here for, to basically bring children forth or to then populate the earth. Part of marriage. That's why I spoke on why children should not be having previous to marriage. We forgot about that a long time ago. Health, the health of you too, the care. So when that other party starts to maybe fall in health, their health get weak, you're there to help them go through, to help their, try to strengthen their health. But when they can't care for themselves, that's your responsibility. You take with the oath, the care, to be there, the nurture, the help. We forget about that as well. And the last one is prayer. It's spelled P-H-E-R-A, an assertion of bounds of the vows. Basically, you put your hand on her hand, and you make a round to where all those vows are encompassed, and they stay inside. You live, you do that every single day of your marriage. So to me, you don't understand this, and you can't basically work with that, you should not be getting a license to get married. It's just that simple. If you're not going to take it that way, what are you doing? Because I've always heard this, and I don't think no one pays attention to this at all when they step to get married. This is said all the time. One of the first things the minister says, justice of the peace, says when you get married, it should not be entered lightly. Does that make sense to folks, Mr. DeRace?
I think there's so many things that are on people's minds and agendas that they have to step into this that, you know, all the things that you just said doesn't even matter. It's people go on their feelings at that particular moment. They feel like they even get pressure from families. I know people who get pressure from families. Like, when you getting married? When you settling down? When you doing this? When you almost like you're herding them into this thing that they have to, like, they have to do it in their lives, and it's really sad that, you know, we have a society that, you know, perpetuates this, that, you know, this is the next step. When you get into your 20s or mid-20s, that this is what you should be doing. People are doing this, and then finding that I'm not happy with this. I'm not. So it's so many things and distractions that come before this, and why you should do this, and feeling obligated to do this. Well, I think all that stuff that, you know, you're really supposed to be thinking about and making step-by-step, progression towards this particular goal and this beautiful kind of gesture you're making, not only to each other but to your creator, is just kind of gone for naught. And you, like I said earlier, you do not, people who are married do not live in a society that supports marriage. It doesn't. It does not support marriage. It does not support people being together. It's more suited to try to strip people from that. You got this phenomenon of side pieces. You got this phenomenon, you know, where, you know, I can cheat at the person and not doing what they're supposed to be doing, in, you know, what they agreed to in the wedding vows and all this other stuff. You have people, you know, in various situations where they don't want to give up their, you know, autonomy and say, you know, I'm exclusively with this person. I still want to live, feel single when I'm out, but, you know, in the home, I'll act like I'm married. So you have so many distractions, so many things in outside society that doesn't, it's supposed to be, when you get married, the community is supposed to be there to help support you. Where do you see that now? You don't see that now. You have family, but, well, girl, leave him. If he ain't doing such and such, he can't do it, leave him. You know, the girlfriend's there. The guys, you know, we as guys, we like, you know, sucks to be you. And so, you know, you're trying to live with your boys now. You're trying to run with your boys now. I'm like, no, you can't do that. But you don't want to lose their friendship. So you go out there and you probably, you know, you don't want to lose your manhood, you know, rank and whatever. And you go out there and do things that you know you got no business doing, you know, trying to keep up with them and trying to keep that, you know, sense that, you know, who you are when you're with them. But then you have to play another, you know, role when you're with your wife and things of that sort. So marriage, to me, as far as community and the society, we don't support that. That's what I think about when I see two people married. Like, how can I support that? How can I, when the brother's going astray or my friend is going astray, it's like, bro, you don't want to do this. So, you know, you don't want to, you know, step out. You don't want to do such and such and such. Where do you hear the society and community doing that? When it comes down to marriage these days, and you don't, and we don't support that. We don't listen to all that stuff. We can care less, because it doesn't mean what I guess originally what it intended to mean, about not only this couple, you know, getting together, but the community to support the couple staying together and being, you know, good to each other, you know, just progressing in life and prospering in life. We don't support that at all. We just support the stuff we come before the wedding. We just turn them loose after the wedding, and they're on their own.
You're dead on. You're dead on. Again, I want to salute and thank Kara Brokenbrough. This young sister decided that she was going to wear a wedding dress that cost $47. And by doing so, she's brought to our attention. You know, for those that was unaware, we can open up our minds and see. She really brought to our attention what a wedding really should stand for. And in her words, you should have a wedding with a witness there to witness you vowing to your spouse, vowing to God. You vowing to your spouse, vowing to God that you guys are going to stay together for life. That's what it's about.
Forsake you. No matter what you're going through, I have good news for you. I'll be with you always.
I'll never leave.
Oh, na, na, na. No matter what you're going through,
no matter what you're going through,
I got some good news for you.
I'll be with you always.
And when,
Mr. Maurice, years ago, you and I had the opportunity. I didn't even know you was there. It's interesting to think about this, that I didn't know you were there. But years ago, Minister Louis Farrakhan called out for 1 million men to meet into Washington, and we all came in different forms and different ways to get there, came from different locations. And saying I didn't know you was there, even though I felt you there, but I didn't know you was in Washington. I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, you and I talked about you going, and none of that took place. But that day itself was based on atonement. And even to this day, when I think about it, there's still a light for that day in my heart, in my recollection, and in my thoughts, because that day was beautiful in so many ways. But even beyond that, the word itself still resonates. It still takes a part, and it still stands strong. And I think sometimes we need to go back, all of us that revisit, that were there, for those, I remember when that was happening, there were some cats afraid to go because they thought things were going to happen, whatever the case may be. And I feel sorry for the men that chose not to go for that reason. But I know I heard it at the time. They, you know, they thought all of that. It didn't show up. But for those that were there, and I feel sorry for the ones that didn't make it, but they probably watched on television, watched something. I'm hoping that we all got the meaning of the Day of Atonement, and that it still has resonated through our lives years beyond, because to me, that's what it should have done, a reparation for a wrong. Atonement is closely associated to forgiveness. It really is when you think about it. It plays a part in forgiveness, but there are two separate things when it comes down to it. An apology is a speech in one's defense, while atonement is an action that repairs a broken connection. And for me, both of them are needed for me in a sense when I look at having joy in my life. You know, and I'm always joyful, bro. Always. You know, I have people say to me all the time, why do you smile so much? Why not? You know, that's what resonates inside of me. So it comes out in my face. I can't contain it. It comes out. There's the smile. But I can't see myself with it if I didn't found the way throughout the point of my life to atone and apologize. And I'm here to say today, if you find someone is bitter, that is basically always grumpy, mad about something, check their level of atonement. Check their level of apology. Either offering one or doing something. Because to me, I don't think you can have clear joy without atonement and an apology being real present and upfront in your life. I just want to get your reaction to that, sir.
Yeah, I remember that day, too. It was a powerful day. And I remember my father being there, and I didn't get to see him. So there were a lot of people that were there who we didn't talk before that we were going, we were doing this, but we were there. And you could feel the presence, not only of people who were there, but people who weren't there that you were thinking of. And that atonement is a big tool. It's a big tool in really freeing yourself. Because, you know, in any situation I am, what I try to do, and I attempt to do, if I've wronged somebody, I apologize, and then I keep a step and I move on. I don't sit there and kind of wallow in that, you know, what else can I do to, you know, make you, you know, feel whole again? No, I move on because I don't want that holding me back from anything. But doing something that it symbolizes that, you know, I am sorry for my mistake, and getting that forgiveness to move on and that permission to move on and not holding yourself back and thinking that, because I do think we chain ourselves when we do something wrong, we're forgiven for it, and then we keep holding on to it. So atonement is that you know, Louis Farrakhan, I think in his wisdom, he said, you know, a lot of these brothers ain't going to make it to Mecca where you do your atonement. So we're going to do it right here in D.C. where a lot of these monuments and things that are here were built by Africans. And this is as close to atonement to Mecca and forgiving ourselves and also forgiving ourselves so we can move as a group of people. And with that freedom that we are forgiven for anything that we've done to our people, ourselves, other people. And we were putting the world on notice that if you don't make atonement, you're going to suffer. We're going to keep going and being successful. But if you don't make atonement, if America doesn't make atonement for their sins, then you will come down. And so I think I took that message from that day too, that we as black men living in America, and I, you notice what I say, black Americans, I like black men living in America, that we were making atonement for some, you know, things that we might have done being under this country. But if you, we were trying to give an example that if America doesn't make atonement for what you did, the atrocities all around the world, what you did to folks that were already here, what you did to folks that you brought here, and what you're still doing, then you will come down and you will suffer the consequences of not making that atonement. So when I hear that word and I think of that day, I think you're right. It's so many things that come to mind as far as not only us atoning as black men and Africans in the diaspora, but putting an example that this is what men do, this is what men who fear their creators do, and that we were putting the world on notice that we were asking for atonement because we want that freedom to be who we are and to strive to be better and to pull people, not only people that look like us to forward, but people who make that step also, move them forward as a country.
Recently, we talked about this cat a couple of months ago on the show, and he came out recently and said some things that strike me as being very interesting. And it flows into atonement and apology, and it flows into some wedding vows as well. And I'm speaking of one Shaquille O'Neal. He took blame for the divorce from his ex-wife, Shani O'Neal. He stated that he started living a double life when he was married. His marriage was 7 years. And he went back to say she was awesome and that he didn't do a good job of protecting her and protecting those vows. That's deep right there. And a lot of times when we, in a sense of divorce or whatever, we don't want to talk about the vows when it doesn't work. We don't even think about when we get married. But again, when it's over, we don't want to talk about them. We act like it don't exist. But he specifically brought that into the conversation. He knows that he didn't protect those vows. He didn't protect her. And here's what's interesting when I say about the atonement and the apology, because this is what I read into when he says this, or he feels this way, because his ex-wife is engaged to be married, and he says, I'm happy for her. There's no way he can be there if he hasn't basically atoned or apologized for what he's done. There's that joy. You can't be happy for somebody else if you won't have the joy inside of your heart. It doesn't exist. Those things don't go. That cake can't be made. And there was a time when I guess they weren't speaking or whatever, and they went around that, and they're good with each other now. And I'm sure he didn't go into deep details, and that's his personal life. But I'm going to bet that atonement and an apology was there, sincere one. So I want to get your reaction, because a lot of times our role we play in a marriage may not working or didn't go fulfilled to what its destiny supposed to have been. You know, a lot of times we look at marriage and they don't work, like I fail. I'm not going to say you fail. I never look at people that get divorced as a failure. For whatever reasons, you didn't make it to where you was trying to go. It could have been because you weren't aware, you weren't capable, whatever. But I look at it as if you choose to step in and it doesn't work, I'm not going to say it's a failure. You tried. You earnestly tried. If you had it in your heart to do that, that's enough for me. But to me, it says something when a man can stand back, see his faults, understand his faults, and take full responsibility of those faults and those blames, and don't allow that to basically poison his joy. I realize even in spite of that, I must still forgive myself and still be able to be joyous. To me, that's amazing, Mr. Maurice. When I hear that and see that in any man, I'm like, that brother gets it. He honestly gets it. He walks with it. Because we're all going to do things that we're not happy with in life, that we're not proud of. You know, we're going to put ourselves in certain situations because sometimes we just don't know any better. We're just stupid to be stupid at times. That's just how it is. But when you can basically, honestly, sincere, see that and be able to understand and take responsibility to acknowledge it and understand that the blame comes here. Don't push it anywhere else. Let it sit in your lap. Feel that weight. Feel that heat. Deal with it. When I come across that, man, I'm in awe, my brother. I want to get your reaction.
Yeah, I know on the sports show we get on Shaquille a lot. Things that he does well, things he doesn't do well, things of that sort, things that he says. But I really had to commend him on this one because not too many men would step forward, and not too many males would step forward to be men. And I will say that. And so that's one of the things about being a man is that you admit when you're wrong, and you're not you don't kind of just push away the responsibilities or the consequences of your action. So when I think about this too, I think about his mom and his dad, who are probably good examples of this, and kind of put in his ear like, you lost a good one. Or he's probably realizing that, things that he contributed to them not being together, thinking it was just her. But living that lifestyle of being rich and famous and being an athlete is very hard. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really support you being married. And we've heard a number of stories about athletes who, living a lifestyle where, they're being attacked and they're being approached all the time. And, some of them fall you know, fall to temptation sometimes. And so it's really good to see, you know, somebody that prominent and you know, a celebrity just come out and say, you know what, you know, this is what I did. And I didn't really handle this really well. And it just sounds like he is resolved in that fact that, hey, she's happy. That's the most important thing to me. And that she's going to be treated well and being happy and realizing that, you know, you had a chance, you did some things that really contributed to you not being together, but you still want that other person to be happy, whether or not. I think that's true love, to be honest, that you want that person to be happy whether they're with you or not, that you care about that person so much that if you're the one that's hurting them, you realize that you need to be out of their lives so that they can live their best life. And so I think that's where he's kind of got to in his journey. And it's really good to see somebody admit that, and who is not trying to sell a book or trying to sell something. They're saying that out of the goodness of their heart, and they're getting out in front of the story in case people are like, you know, Shaquille O'Neal's ex-wife is getting married and all this stuff, and trying to cause division between that throughout the news cycle. But him getting out in front of it and saying, hey, I was, you know, contributed to us not being together, and I've grown as a person, and I've grown as a man, and I'm willing to show that in the public that I can do this. And hopefully that could be an example for other men.
Absolutely, bro. No, you're right. Hopefully that can be a strong example, because I think a lot of times, you know, when we, you know, we're not there, if we decide to, for whatever reason, things don't work out, we move on, we kind of take issue sometimes. This is things that I'm speaking to men at this point, because I already know for the most part women do this, but I want to speak to men when I say this, because even though, especially if you have kids and the kids are in the middle, it's incumbent upon you to really, in front of her and the kids, you got to go out of your way to make sure the kids still see her how she needs to be seen. So I say that to say that if you're showing disrespect to her, if you're treating her a certain way because you're no longer with her, or the case may be, it falls back to the kids. And I don't think as men we pay attention to that. You know, we don't see that in a sense, because the kids are always paying attention. They don't have to look to pay attention. We think that kids have to be kind of standing there and looking at you. Kids pay attention. They may never verbalize it, but they see it. But they can respect you and honor you more even when you're not there. And when you're there, you're showing respect in a sense. And they know you two may not choose to be together or whatever the case may happen. They'll find a way with communication, understand that. But when you're around and they see the tension and the disrespect and the discord, it makes it harder for them. And at the same time, we have to understand as men too, our men, our younger men, our younger boys are learning how to relate and deal with women by the way they see us deal with their mom, whether we want to believe it or not. You know, if you're treating his mother like she's not worth whatever, if you're talking about her in a language that's not befitting of a woman, he starts to look and view women as such. Because all of us, as men, our first love is our mother. The first woman that we fell in love with and that we love dearly is our mom. Now, where that relationship goes after a period of time, it goes there. But that's what it is. So when a young boy sees his father totally disrespectful to his mother and doesn't care, he starts to look and wonder, okay, this is how it's supposed to be. He takes on that pattern. He may start to live in those shoes and think, this is how I can basically be such. So, again, we have to be, when that does, I respect wholeheartedly, like I said, I think what he did is awesome. But I'm just speaking to situations where, because sometimes we come across and there's a lot of tension, a lot of stuff going on, and we allow that to play itself out and manifest itself in the way we're treating her. And my thing is, once you realize you're not going to no longer be with her, then it is what it is. All that tension and stuff that's going back to her, it's not necessary. I can understand if you two are still trying to work it out. I got that. But when you decide you're going to move forward with all of that. Take it all with you and don't bring it back, because bringing it back can do damage. I want to, because we have basically a tone in this show that we're going to do a little bit in a little bit, but I want to kind of go to why, because you touched on it, you know, him about being a man. Why is it that we are hesitant as people to atone and apologize? Why we tend to run from doing one of those two things, Mr. Demarest, in your opinion?
I think sometimes it's our pride that we feel like everything we do, we're justified in doing, and that we have a reason that we're doing, and we don't want to be wrong, and we don't want people to point out that we're wrong. And that's why I said that I think his parents had a lot to do with that too, because, you know, he may have had some questions, he may have said some things, he may have noticed some things on how she's probably treating the children now and how happy she is and all this other stuff. And he's probably like coming to some self-realization like, man, you know, I remember when she was that happy when I was there. And why did that change? You know, and when did that change? And he probably did some self-reflection like, oh, when I was dipping out here and wasn't paying attention here, you know, I left her by herself. I left her there on her own. I was out on the road doing my thing, and I didn't check in with her. And I, you know, because I'm an athlete, and everybody thinks I'm important. And the person that's supposed to be the most important in your life, you're kind of just leaving in limbo. So I think that you know, sometimes it takes us a while to kind of self-evaluate and do that self-reflection and say, what did I do to contribute to this? I have a good friend who, he would always do that. He does this to this day. If I come to him with a problem, the first thing he'll ask is, what did you do to contribute to this? He doesn't blame the other person. You already told him what the other person did or what the situation was. And it's like, well, what did you do before this or to get this problem to this point now? And it's one of the most frustrating things, because you know he's coming with the question, but you're hoping that, you know, that he listens to you and that he takes your side, but he doesn't. He's impartial, and he'll go, okay, I hear what you're saying, but what was your contribution? And I could tell he's probably one of those principals too, because he's the principal of a elementary school, and he's probably doing the same thing to his students, like, okay, I want to hear your side, and I want to hear your side. But sometimes it takes us a while to get that self-reflection, self-evaluation of ourselves to say, you know what, I might have had something to do with this, and I need to take the blame for the part I played in this. And I think sometimes that takes maturity, because we don't want to be wrong. We always want to save face, and we don't want to look bad. And sometimes I think when I go from the beginning, it's that pride that we hold on to that keeps us from doing that sometimes.
Man, I love it, bro. I love it. I had a big smile on my face when you said that to you, man, because I have instilled that in my kids, man, from early childhood on, and I'm a big proponent of that. Always look to see the role you played in any situation before you kind of make a big rash judgment. Okay, what did I do inside of this? Because it's easy to point the finger and go, bah, 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 bah. Okay, what did I do? What role did I play? You know, what should I be taking responsibility for? And there comes the clarity, because sometimes people feed off of what you're doing. They're giving a reaction to your action. And it's easy when things happen to go, you know, yeah, what did you do? What role did you play? And we really need, honestly, we need people in our lives that what he does for you or has done for you, that's what we need, bro. We don't need people, yeah, having your back. Screw that having your back. I don't want you to have nothing for me. You know, if I come to you and I say something, I want it real, I want it straight, I want it there. And that's where if I'm off kilter, if I'm not right, I can get there because I want to be correct. And that's it. That's it right there. And I think there's a lot of reasons why, like you said about the pride, why it's hard for folks. Because we don't want to acknowledge, even if we know sometimes we're wrong, we don't want to acknowledge that. And we think if we acknowledge it to you or a person, it make us less than. You're going to look at us as being whatever. And we spend too much time trying to be something that, damn it, that we're not in the first place. We think it make us less than. But we ain't hard. You ain't hard to start. You weren't born to be hard. It's something that you think that you should be. It is what it is. It's something that you think. Black men kill me with that bullshit. I'm being honest. We think that we hard, that we have to be. No, you weren't born to be hard, bro. It's been sold to you by a bunch of people that's been trying to manipulate your mind, and you walk around thinking that's who you must be. Seriously. Because that ain't nothing about hard is where we're supposed to be living. It's not. It's just not. If we understand who you are and your place in this, why you were placed in this earth, that's not what you're here for. But we spend so much time trying to be that. So now, anything that deviates from that, we think, nah, I ain't doing nothing. Nah, learn who you are. You know, all that extra stuff that's been sold to you from different vices, that's not your nature. That's not who you are. But as I said earlier, man, we basically have done this before, and we will continue to do it, atone for some things that we did wrong. And as I was putting this together, you know, a few days ago, when my mind was starting to think, I wanted to go back, and I, you know, not that I approached this with her at the time, but I wanted to kind of bring this up and say this because I remember, and I'm not saying I think it would have made, in my heart of hearts, this would have made a difference in my life, of my marriage life. But prior to getting married, I was, with another woman. And that basically, when she found out that made her feel a certain way about me. She brought that into the marriage. And bringing that in, it caused her to feel a certain way at certain times. Now, did that totally bombard our marriage? No. Did it make some things a little strained? Absolutely. But even when that came to light, there was my atonement for it. There was my apology. And that's something that was needed. I could have tried to, at that time when it became clear, I could have basically treated like, nah, played it down, act like it, I don't understand the importance of it. But no, any woman at that point, you know, is looking to be with someone and realize that, okay, he did X, Y, Z. There's got to be a feeling behind it. There's got to be a hurt behind it. There's got to be something behind it. And for me to act dumb and stupid about it would be my ignorance. It would just be my plain old ignorance. So for that, at that time, and even at that time when it happened throughout the years of knowing her, I apologize and atone for it. And even in my heart of hearts, over the years, I knew that was the right thing to do. And if I think about it, I'm glad that I did. Am I proud of what took place to get her there? Absolutely not. But I felt like, for me, that was the thing to do as far as atonement and apology. And again, I looked at the joy that I have in my life that I've been experiencing for years, and I believe a huge part of it is given to me and bestowed unto me by God is because I am willing to go back. I'm not perfect. Never claimed to be. Those words will never come out of my mouth. But I will live up to my wrongs. I will live up to my deeds. I will address them. I will atone for them. I will apologize when necessary. And I'm going to tell you this, because I am such, if you're going to be part of this life, you got to be the same way. I don't accept anything less, because I'm not going to give that to you. You can't give it to me. So if you think you're going to come here and be part of this vessel and roll with it that way, if you can't understand that, then don't expect to get what I need to give to you, because it's a two-way street. With that being said, I'll roll to you, Mr. Reese, if it's something that you want to speak into that nature, because, you know, atonement for some people, especially in a public sense, is not easy. It's not easy, but I think it's good. So I'll roll that to you, my brother, and see what you have.
Yeah. I want to atone to the ancestors that came before me, because sometimes I'm not always on my job and carrying out what is in my DNA, the royalty and the purpose of why I'm here in my DNA. And sometimes I'm not as disciplined as I need to be in studying and learning and fulfilling the role and the purpose of being African in the diaspora and really moving our people forward. Sometimes I get frustrated with some of the actions of our people, and I shouldn't. As your buddy always say, pride comes before a fall. And he also says to me, you know, when I'm saying things, you know, remember forgiveness. And he always says also, remember to be humble. And so I have to really stick to those things in order to fulfill the purpose of the ancestors that came before us. And sometimes I kind of put pressure on myself saying, you know, all the problems we have and things of that sort and what the way conditions are. But they paved the way to make it better. And so I need to have that same spirit to make it better for people that come after me. And so I want to atone to the ancestors for not being on my duty at times and discipline sometimes to carry out what they put forth for me to do and us to do as a people.
Ancestors, man, I said this last year. We haven't done it yet, so I'm going to make it a point where, you know, you and I, Mr. Charles, next month, the end of May, about this time, we're going to do a show where we have our letter ready, a letter to our ancestors. And I think that's a good thing in a sense where we take some time because a month or so is needed. A letter to our ancestors is not something we should probably attempt to do within a day or a few days or a week. I want us to really take some time, you know, write a little bit. You're a writer. So I'm sure sometimes you write, you go back, you revise, you add, whatever. And I want us to really open up and write a letter to our ancestors and imagine. And this is for me, as I thought about this morning, and I thought about it, man, I said, you know, some of this may even hurt, bro. But, I mean, just speaking for myself, because just like you said, you feel sometimes you may have, you know, what you're feeling might let them down. But, you know, hurt for me is to revisit and think about what they had to live and what they had to go through. For me to sit right here and be able to talk like I do and have this conversation, you know, I didn't get here on my own. I mean, this journey that I walk and journey that I live was planned out and designed for me a long time ago, long before I was placed inside my mother's womb. You know, God had this in store. So for me not to be able to look back and pay honor to those that did what they did, that couldn't stand up and say some of the things that I could say, couldn't go some of the places that I can go. So for that alone, I know I need to go back and say thank you and pay honor to. So we will, man. We will, you know, we know now that by next month around this time, we're going to take out a portion of the show and take our letter and read our letter and give explanation to it. And that should be nice, bro. I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. With the time we have left, man, I know you come with questions, bro. So if you know, I've been throwing them out at you for the past so many minutes. So, man, here you are, mom. Here you are, cuz, your question.
Yeah, I know we probably not going to have enough time to talk about this because we talked about it a little bit offline. But I want, hopefully you'll share some of the stuff we talked about offline. But when you're talking to a woman and she makes the comment, I'm going to let a man be a man, what does that mean to you?
Basically saying to you that I'm going to allow you to do X, Y, Z, but don't understand this, that I'm allowing you to be this, to be with me, but I'm going to basically run this. So when she takes the order, I think a lot of times we're just out of order in certain things. And I can't allow a woman to be a woman, and a woman can't allow a man to be a man. But if I think I can allow you to be a woman, then I'm already wrong. I'm wrong. And she's wrong. She's dead wrong because she's assuming that she is part man and that she takes on the role of a man. And I don't care what you do, you're never a man. When you came out your mother, if you was a woman, I don't care how many operations you get, whatever the case you get, and what you want to call yourself, you are what you came out to shoot as being. So you are primarily a woman, sis. So when you say to him, I'm going to allow you to be, no woman has a right to allow a man to be a man. And no man has a right to allow a woman to be a woman. That's just the natural order of things. So what she's saying to you, I already done strip you of your natural order. I'm going to give you some back, so you feel okay. But I done stripped you of that, bro. I done taken that away from you. And if he can't see that or hear that, then the question falls back on him, what's wrong? How do you not see that as being really a hit, a attack on you as a man? That's it. Your response.
Yeah, I mean, we had an in-depth conversation about this, and I wanted to bring it to the show. But, you know, when she says, you know, I'm going to allow him or let him be the man, it's up to her. She's saying that's up to her, where if you don't meet certain standards that she thinks you should meet as a man, then she's going to pull the reins or pull rank and say, okay, I gave you your chance to do what you're supposed to do. Now I'm taking over because obviously you ain't up for the task. And usually you find that in alpha females who feel like they're the man anyway. And so they will try to kind of have that kind of rule over you. And so I remember talking to a buddy about this recently and saying, you know, I said, did she say exactly that? And he said, yeah. I said, you need to run. You need to run. You don't need to be in that relationship because you can't allow her to be a woman. She is a woman, and she can't allow you to be a man. You're already a man. And if there's some things that she doesn't like about, you know, who you are, then those things, and she probably won't say it now, but those things she'll try to change, because women always like to try to change men into who they want them to be. Then once he becomes that, then they don't like him anymore, and they're probably stepping out, you know, going out with a more alpha prototype man. So, you know, you men, and I know my buddy's not the only one going through this, but when you hear a woman say, I'm going to allow you, or she's already taken the authority of the relationship, she's already taken authority of your manhood, and if you're not going to meet up to her standards. You're not. She's already fixed in her mind that she's going to have to shape you into being who she wants you to be. You do not want to be in a relationship. If you're not coming in a relationship where I appreciate and love the way this person is, and, you know, and I'm not talking about, you know, making somebody better or bringing out the best in them. You know, those things you should be doing in a relationship. But that tells me that she's going to change you or try to shape you in her image. She's a woman, and she can't shape a man into a woman. You just can't. It's not going to work. So she's basically telling you, I'm the alpha dog, and I make all the decisions on whether or not this works, whether or not I'm happy, or whether or not you're living up to my standards. Brothers, know your worth. Know your worth when you're stepping in these relationships, and don't ever let a woman take that away from you, or you'll be a la Will Smith in a situation where you have a woman that you can never make happy, and you wind up embarrassing yourself as a man, emasculated.
Ooh. You know, you said something there, Beth. You said a lot. Great stuff, bro, but something there that I wanted to kind of just hit real quickly, because a lot of women spend a lot of time trying to make men what they want them to be. They won't be honest about it, but they do. They spend a lot of time trying to make, and that's where a lot of times sometimes when we get in situations where they're right, but they think they can make it better because you're trying to get him, and he's fighting against that. That's not who he is. But yeah, they wait for that boat to turn back around, but that is so important because they do spend a lot of time trying to change a man from just who he is, whoever he is. Whatever it is, they're trying to make you comfortable. They want to make themselves comfortable. In order for them to be comfortable, they need to mold you like Play-Doh, like clay, to get you to be what's going to fit them. So they can't take you the way you're there. You are. No, I need you. It can be simple things. I need them to be this way, so I'm going to do X, Y, Z. It's almost like they're trying to reprogram you mentally, like you're
exactly.
A robot.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to program you mentally to have you so things would be the way they need to be. And what should happen, it should be a conversation. This is what I like. This is what I like to have. And you two discuss it. But they feel they're all great and they're all women, that they're smarter than you anyway. Because like I said before, you're nothing but a wallet. That's all you are. So they feel they can basically have you, even when it doesn't work. They feel like they can do this because they're all great, they're almighty. They have something between their legs that you just fall over head over heel for. So, yeah, I can get you to do sex while, you know, I can get you to do that. You got another question, sir? Be happy to partake.
You know, I was thinking of that. I was thinking about what you said. It's a manipulation game. It's manipulating you to be the person that they feel that they should have or feel that they want at that moment. Because women always change their minds of what they want from day to day, from moment to moment, things of that sort. So I look at it as manipulation. And there's some key things that they say, or they'll start suggesting certain things. Well, I think you should do this, such and such and such and such and such. And sometimes as men, we let it go unchecked because we just kind of view it as, oh, they just talking. But day after day, kind of putting that in your head, I'll give you a good example of this. I have a cousin who I remember, he doesn't like blue cheese dressing. All my life I know he doesn't like blue cheese dressing. I'm sitting with him and his wife at the time, and we order food, and they bring out the salad. And so the lady asked him, the waitress asked him, what kind of dressing do you like? And so he was looking, kind of thinking, and I can see her kind of looking. She wasn't looking at him. She was kind of thinking, almost like she was, like, transmitting information to his head. And he was probably, because she likes to dip into the salad, his salad. He said, you know what? I think I'm going to have blue cheese dressing. And I looked at him and was like, you don't like blue cheese dressing. He said, well, I think I'm going to have blue cheese dressing. And I'm like, and all of a sudden when he said that, she kind of looked straight like she wasn't transmitting anymore. The message that he wanted to answer. I said, I'm like, oh my God, she's got him. You got a mind control over Devo. I'm like, because I know this brother. I've known him from, you know, like I started breathing. And he's like, he doesn't like blue cheese dressing. He complains about, he's animate about not blue. But for this, it's almost like she was like, wee-wee. You know, she had mind control over him. He turned his head thinking, she was turning her head thinking, you know, if I look harder, you can see the transmission connecting the brain. And she was like, order blue cheese dressing. And he ordered it, and I'm like, you don't like that. You know, we've never gone out at home. It's a crib. You would go without dressing instead of choosing blue cheese. What made you do that? Oh, I don't know. I don't know what made me. I'm like, oh, my God, you got my control. So it's a manipulation thing. It's a manipulation. You know, it's like you warm down. You know, it's like, no, you don't think that. Or what I used to hate with my ex-wife, where I would say something and she would go, are you sure? What the hell you mean, am I sure? I just said what I said. I'm like, I'm not double-minded. If I say this, this is what I want. You sure? I tell everybody that I'm in a relationship with, don't ask me. If you ask me a question, I'll give you an answer. Don't ask me the way to really kind of set this thing off wrong. Asking me if I'm sure. You sure you want to eat? You sure you're hungry? You sure you? Ooh. You got me riled up on a Sunday morning, bro.
I love it, bro. I love it, bro. I love it. But it's reality because if you were
to after that.
It's funny because if you were to ask him, well, he's only doing that for no, like you said. That has been put into motion long before they sat at that table. The mind translation, yeah, it's been done for a while. So he knows now, and what he was trying not to do when it came up is do it in front of you because he knows what you know. But she has basically wore into him, leaned into him to where now his decision-making is based on what's going to make her feel comfortable. And I'm not saying you should make your mate not feel comfortable, but it should be your own taking. It should not be a game where you done been manipulated, you done been molded to feel such and think that, okay, I must do X, Y, Z. And that's just, I remember, you know, there's a guy in my job, man, and that used to, he's a brother, and then three of us was working together 5 days a week. And it was myself, him, and a white guy. He's been married for years. And he used to say this from time to time. And I'm telling you, man, we wanted to choke this man when he said this. A happy wife is a happy life. I'm like, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? And where do you think he got that from?
Seriously,
a happy wife. Because he's done been told. He's done been shown. Yeah. If I'm
if
not
she ain't
happy,
nobody going to be happy.
You ain't going to be happy. Oh. And I'm like, bro, you done succumbed to that for a long time. I mean, you don't nobody walk up. I've never heard a woman say, a happy husband is a happy or good, a smiling man. What? How does, and men, to me, are so stupid to say that. Oh, a happy life is a happy, maybe you got the wrong wife, that's why you're unhappy, bro. You don't want to see that, but we can call yourself from the outside. You got the wrong one. Because if she's playing, she ain't going to never be happy. Let me say that again. She ain't going to never be happy. That's not her desire to be happy. She don't wake up in the morning to be happy.
Bro, you ever hear a guy? You ever been around a married guy who, you know, you talking to him, you two are alone. You're two alone. And she ain't nowhere around. And he getting ready to say something. He go, no, I can't say that. I can't say that. Well, what do you mean you can't say? You can't talk. She ain't here. Say what you got to say, man. No, I shouldn't say that. So it's like you got them trained. You know, you don't say this. You don't do this. You don't act this way. You know, you act funny when you're around your friends. Blah, 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 blah. It's almost like he's like programmed, man. She reaches inside your head and twists some things around. We're alone. She is nowhere around, bro. Say what you got to say. This is your free time.
I was at a cookout years ago. This guy invited me to this housewarming, bro. This is no lie. And I never met his wife before. It's my first time meeting her, right? So I had left, and I came back. So when I came back, he was down at the bottom of the driveway talking to another guy. And I walked up, and we started having conversation. He was telling the guy how I worked together and how, you know, he feels a certain way about me. Bro, she was up on the top of the hill. And she looked down, and she saw us three in gesture having a good time. I'm watching out of my peripheral. She stood there, stared for a while. You know, she came right down there and bust that up. I'm cracking up inside. She could have turned away and walked. He's having a good time with two other jump. No. What are they talking about? They're laughing. What are they doing? That can't be. And I said, as she started to come down, I said, bro, we may want to arrest your wife. And he said, oh, okay. Now, I mean, I don't know what she thought he was talking about, but she wasn't going to have that, bro. She wasn't. He cannot have a conversation if she's not there running the strings and be happy. When she saw he was smiling and I'm smiling and the other cat's smiling, we laughing. Oh, it's over,
That's a no-no.
It's over. No, you can't be, bro. You can't be. But you're right. And it's they don't even understand it. They've been beat down so bad, so bad. And I know people that will look at this and go, no, trust me, it's what it is, what we see.
Yeah,
they've been beat down so bad to where they don't know again. Because if you give an opportunity to talk, they're going to tell you, a happy life. As a happy wife, man, we got to kind of get out of here, man. But I think at some point we got to go back and hit this up because this deserves more of our attention and more of our focus. Because it's that, like you said, man, I know a loss of space when you talked about that, those waves going. That's amazing. Hey, man, I appreciate it. We'll get together soon. It's what black men talk. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo